1996 Sunstone Symposium presents session number 332, In Dialogue with the Environment, Diverse Mormon Views on Land and Community. A panel including Hardy Redd, Steve Rich, and P. Jane Hafen.
Ladies and gentlemen, brothers and sisters, I believe we'll start. If I'll get organized. This is session 332, In Dialogue with the Environment, Diverse Mormon Views on Land and Community. Part of this panel is an outgrowth from an attempt and a venture by Bill Smart and Carrie Tempest Williams to ask for essays of various Mormons and non-Mormons, I guess, on how the Mormon experience, the theology and the church and settling in the West, has influenced their views about the environment. And so that's the thesis of this panel this morning. The way I think I would like to do it is that as moderator panelist, I will take the first a little while, and then we'll ask Jane Hafen to speak next, and then followed by Steve Rich. I'm going to introduce Jane now. She's an assistant professor of English at the University of Nevada in Las Vegas. Her specialty is Native American literature, and she's done extensive writing and researching in Native American literature. The best part about her, she was born in Cortez, Colorado, or she was raised in Cortez, Colorado, which is very close to where I live. Steve Rich is an environmental educator in resource management, but he is comes from Jacobs Lake, where he and his family have been in the ranching business, in the livestock business, in the land management business, but also in the tourist business. Am I right about that? One of the reasons I put Steve last is he's more entertaining than I am, and so he'll wake you up after you've heard mine. I really wrestled with writing this because I have a difficult time writing and expressing my viewpoint. And I sent it in after about 10 revisions. And Bill Smart wrote me a letter, as editors do, and said, "This is really good, but we want it changed. We want it better." And so I'm in the process of doing that now. One of my fundamental beliefs that influences how I think about the environment is not the sacredness of the earth particularly, but the sacredness of each individual person. The earth is sacred, but individuals, in my priority, the individual is more sacred. Jesus taught that each individual is precious in his or her own right. Out of that comes my belief that only in freedom can an individual's sacredness be preserved and protected and enhanced. Only in freedom, or best in freedom, can an individual grow, increase, and improve. I'm deeply committed to individual human choice in religious, political, and economic matters, as well as how they use their property. I believe this earth was formed as a living place where the individual could gain in knowledge, character, wisdom, and otherwise enlarge her spirit. In order for God's purposes to be realized, a necessary premise is individual freedom of choice. Only in freedom can an individual make choices, good choices and bad choices, and grow. Inherent in freedom is the risk of error, hurt, pain, but it also can lead to discovery, improvement, and enlargement. I define freedom in two ways. There are a lot of ways to define it, but one is to leave people alone in their own lives as long as they do not impose on other people's freedom. More specifically, to let others use their time and their property as they choose. One of the other beliefs I have that I think I get from my religion is optimism. That God would not have formed the earth and put us here unless he expected that we succeed. That we have, as individuals and collectively, a purpose and a destiny. That man is essentially good, and even that he can use and will use the earth and its resources wisely and prudently, if he's knowledgeable and if he is given the proper incentives. I can choose to be negative and pessimistic, as many people are. I've heard a few of the folks in this, in other sessions of the symposium, look on the dark side and say we're ruining the earth. There's plenty of evidence to support that particular viewpoint if you choose to look only at that area. Or I can look on the bright side and appreciate all the good things on the earth and all the good things man has done and his ability to correct his mistakes. Two quotes indicate different ways of looking at life and the earth. And I spend some time on these because I think many of us react this way. There's a wonderful scripture in Alma where, towards the end of the book of Alma, where the people are under siege and been involved in a long war. Some of them are humbled and become more righteous, and others choose to become bitter and angry. And I think we can make the same choices. Two quotes. In 1620, Sir Francis Bacon wrote, quote, "Nature, in order to be commanded, must be served, must be obeyed. Nature, in order to be commanded, must be obeyed," unquote. This was the beginning in experimental science and modern engineering, which today successfully commands nature by obeying it. One of the things that Bacon indicated was that if we obey nature's laws and work hard, you cannot believe the improvement that can be made in things. In 1798, Thomas Robert Malthus wrote, quote, "We should facilitate, instead of foolishly and vainly endeavoring to impede, we should facilitate the operations of nature in producing mortality." I think he meant human mortality. "It is almost an argument to kill off the undesirables because he believed population will eventually outstrip resources." Malthus was not the last person to share this view, including some of my environmentalist friends who conclude that man is a virus and should be eliminated, like the AIDS virus and smallpox. Each American farmer today produces enough food to feed 100 people in this nation. Most of us wouldn't be here today without technology. Most of you would be on the farm, probably scything wheat today, engaged in hard physical labor. But because one farmer, Steve Rich, can feed 100 of you, we have the leisure to come and talk about the damage we're doing to the environment. In addition, 32 other people in the world outside of this country are fed by this same farmer. If the premise is there is a God and he is good and the earth was made for the benefit of his children, then there must be hope that his children will succeed. We not only will survive, we will prevail. I believe that the universe is essentially a friendly place, but it's a place that must be used wisely. There's no doubt that individually and collectively we have made and do make mistakes, but I'm convinced That is, the earth is capable of renewing itself. Man is capable of learning and has learned from his mistakes and can correct and mitigate these damages. Example, when I was a young boy and came to Salt Lake, I opened the window on the Hotel Utah and the sill outside was black from soot, from the many coal furnaces that were functioning in the Salt Lake Valley in the wintertime. I don't see that now. That's one of the changes we've made because we wanted to and because there's technology. Many people do not understand what the word resource means. Resource comes from the Latin word resurgere, meaning again to rise, to recover. The evidence of my eye, as well as evidence of scientific measurements carried on over the past 60 years, indicate that the earth is capable of renewal, recovery, and rising again. That evidence, coupled with the optimism that man has the potential for good and that there is a good purpose in the earth, has influenced how I look at the environment. I've seen overgrazed land come back the next year with strong and vigorous plants. I've seen Hatch Wash in San Juan County change from a shallow 20-foot wide stream with denuded banks to a narrow, foot-wide deep stream with overhanging grass, willows, and all other signs of a healthy riparian area. I run cattle in southwest Kansas. The Dust Bowl of the 30s, you've seen the pictures, where there are now more than 1 million acres of lush green forage and crops growing on stable, fertile soil. One of the disadvantages that folks have who live in urban areas is that they come to places like southern Utah and take snapshots. And their snapshots in their minds are just how the earth looks at one particular time or one particular season. Most urban people do not live on the land, do not depend on it, and do not really see it. They do not have a continuum of years of data to adequately judge what it can do. Another influence on how I look at the environment is found in the commandment to love one another. If I love my children, if I really love my children, one of the things I will do is pass on them to them a ranch and a piece of land which is better than I received it. It involves the determination to leave the earth at least as productive and as beautiful as when I found it. Loving one another also means getting along together. It means working together as a community or a group to help each other and to take care of the place where we live. It means giving in sometimes and not getting exactly what I want. Two stories. My grandfather and my great-grandfather were called to settle in San Juan Country from southwestern Utah. After a long, arduous journey, they arrived on the first level bottom land that they had seen in 6 months, and they established a community there grandly called Bluff City. These days when I drive down Cal Canyon and Bluff comes into view, I recall one of the early practices in that community. The pioneers had diverted the San Juan River, building a community ditch to carry irrigation water to crops on individual farms. Scarcity of water meant that it was allocated on a time basis. One farm one day, another farm the next day. Occasionally, Bishop Jens Nelson would hobble painfully across the fields to see whose crops were the driest. His feet had been frozen some 30 years before crossing the plains in a handcart company. Occasionally he would return and say, "Even though Brother Lyman is entitled to the water tomorrow, Brother Jones's field is drier." Without question or argument, the water was turned to Brother Jones. Bishop Nielsen's authority to allocate water was not formally given. I doubt even his ecclesiastical authority even extended to allocating water. But the people trusted him, and this is important, because he was honest, and he was virtuous, and he knew soil, and he knew water. Their experience with him was that he was judicious and fair-minded. They agreed because they knew these things about him, and they also knew that they depended on each other. There was no law or force involved. The good Mormon folk in Bluff were persuaded by the virtue and ability of their leaders and their own desire to put gospel principles into action for the good of another brother and the whole community, whether motivated by necessity or by the ideal of being their brother's keeper and loving their neighbor. Bluff was a community in every sense of the word, and those folks there were saints in the connotation of Latter-day Saints. Across the river from Bluff is the Navajo Indian Reservation. I have a different feeling when I look over, raise my eyes from Bluff and look over at the reservation. This is the memory I have. Claudine Bates Arthur, a Navajo attorney, once made a comment in passing about the look. I presume she meant the history of the Navajo Indians being rounded up by Kit Carson's army, forcibly taken from their homes in southern Utah and Arizona and locked in a New Mexico concentration camp. After a year or so, they were turned loose to straggle back home on their own. This long walk is still in their memory after four generations. Even though Claudine made the comment offhandedly and without rancor, the memory of that use of force, subjugation, and humiliation is still alive in the Navajo people. I much prefer the persuasion and civil, consensual agreement of Bluff City than I do the U.S. government's use of force, power, and tyranny. And I say the power and tyranny of the Kit Carson majority. Not for nothing did the Mormons believe that God told the prophet that power was to be exercised not by force, but rather by persuasion, by kindness, by long-suffering, and gentleness. One of the other things I appreciate, and I'm going to be brief on this, is Christ's disemphasis on material things. He cautioned that too many things, too much wealth, has the possibility of corroding and corrupting the more important soul. Elbert Peck yesterday talked about this a little bit and how it bothers him when he buys luxuries knowing that people are hungry when he's buying a CD. One of the other things that has influenced this that probably is not the gospel, but is probably the experience of living in southern Utah and then going to San Juan. L.H. Red Jr., as a young man, would haul a wagon load of farm produce from their farm in New Harmony to nearby Silver Reef mining settlement. The backhaul was slop from the boarding house for the Red family's pigs. Profligate miners would often throw cracked or chipped dishes into the slop. L.H. would gingerly feel around in the slop to retrieve these dishes, which were then washed and used by the family. L.H. saved dishes, water, and money. After he arrived in Bluff, he worked hard, spent carefully, became wealthy, was too generous, got overextended, and died insolvent. He chided his children, and his children chided me and my sister Beverly about waste of time, about waste of money, about waste of natural resources. Nothing was to be wasted. I feel the same way. On the ranch, we occasionally had excess water in the spring. I was wounded and embarrassed to see water wasted by going down the stream and flowing into the Colorado River and later Lake Powell. Not to use the water that God had put into the mountains for a beneficial use seemed a sin. I feel the same way about timber. When trees grow to a mature age, they are attacked by mistletoe, beetles, infection. And when they die and rot, it's a waste. Somebody could use the wood. Somebody could build a shelter for someone. If unharvested when fire comes, and it will, the large fuel load of fallen trees and brush causes a fire to burn so hot that it kills the young trees, which otherwise might survive a cooler burning fire. Yellowstone's a good example. Such waste is an evil in my theology. Like forest, grass is a renewable resource created by soil, water, minerals, and carbon dioxide and solar energy. The indications, and I think Steve will get into this, indicate that not using resources sometimes is more harmful to them than using them. My belief in the gospel of Jesus Christ has led me to a belief in the preciousness of the individual human being. In order to preserve the individual and allow him or her to become everything possible, freedom of choice is the most important value. If the earth is good, and if man has the capability of being good, then I am optimistic that our ability to venture and to risk, to err, to learn, to change, and to grow. The only way to create a feeling of community and to create civility between individuals is to persuade individuals to unite voluntarily and freely. Communities created by force or coercion, or based on the false economic theories have always failed. Coerced individuals never really form a community. The failed utopian societies in the United States, including in our own Mormon history, are evidence. The Soviet Union and Yugoslavia communities are additional evidence that these kinds of communities not only take away individual freedom, they often cannot even feed themselves. I visited in Eastern Europe and in Russia. In their poverty, they have done more environmental damage in those places than we, a free people, who are freely united in community. The civility implicit in the gospel of Jesus Christ and good relations between neighbors within a community may be the most precious and fragile resource we have. If we can persuade people to a sense of community, of getting along with each other, of solving resource problems and other problems civilly and graciously, of generously seeking not our own, then we will best be able to use and enjoy the earth's resources and pass them on undiminished to the future. Thank you.
Thank you. I'd just like to preface my remarks by saying that this is a very personal essay, and I in no means intend to be a spokesperson for all people of color at this conference, since I seem to be one of the few people of color here. But this essay comes out of my own personal experience.
James, if you stand a little closer to that mic, because this is being taped.
Okay. Is that better?
You bet.
Okay. I am Taos Pueblo. Taos Pueblo indicates my American Indian identity and designates a geographical location. Being and place are inseparable. Taos Pueblo is the most northern pueblo of 19 along the upper Rio Grande River in what is now called New Mexico. Two adobe structures embrace a plaza divided by the Rio Pueblo. The clear water of the river is frigid as it flows down from the Sacred Bloom Lake in the mountains above the pueblo. The river gives life to the Pueblo people and the crops they have cultivated there since before Columbus. My people of the Red Willow, Pueblo, or people in Spanish, have lived on this specific location for over 700 years. When I stand on the north side of the plaza, I can observe the South Pueblo where my father was born. Just beyond the four-story terraced conjoined dwellings of the Pueblo, I can see the towering cottonwood tree that stands beside my grandmother's home, a separate adobe building. The Pueblo itself echoes the horizon of the mountains. I can barely distinguish the kiva poles that provide entrance to the earthen underground chambers where my father worships in his first language, Tiwa. On San Geronimo Feast Harvest Day, I stand on the north to survey the view and hear better the old songs. My pulse throbs with the drums as I feel the ancient blood of my people flowing through my veins. When I consider the genetic factors in my blood, I know that I have inherited a predisposition to gallbladder disease, high blood pressure, and diabetes, an intolerance to milk, fats, and sugars introduced by European contact. Nevertheless, the same blood that annoys my current life also endured the onslaught of virgin soil diseases carried by European domesticated animals, measles, smallpox, chickenpox. My particular ancestors outlasted not only virulent diseases, but violent conflicts with the Spanish conquistadores and American invaders. The Pueblo peoples were the only Native Americans to successfully expel the Europeans. In the Pueblo Revolt of 1680, initiated at Taos, the natives reclaimed their sovereign rights, their land, their religion. When the Spanish were readmitted 12 years later, it was according to the terms agreed upon by the Pueblos. Though I may not be the fittest, I know I have the genes of survival. In addition to physical survival, Taos culture is among the most intact of Native peoples. The ritual practices of the Taos people have weathered the influences of Hispanic Catholicism, American capitalism, inquisitive anthropologists, and the admiration of Bohemian artists such as D.H. Lawrence, Willa Cather, Mary Austin, Frank Waters, George O'Keefe, Ansel Adams, John Marin, Andrew Dossberg, and other lesser-known writers and painters. Native individuals have maintained their Taos practices despite systematic attempts to mainstream and acculturate them through the government boarding schools, education, and missionary proselytizing. Undoubtedly, the traditions will also endure the current fascination of New Age pseudo-spirituality and Santa Fe chic as well. The nuclear age has brushed against the Pueblo, too. Los Alamos, the Manhattan Project, and Trinity Site are not far from Taos. In desperate poverty, neighboring tribes have succumbed to economic temptations. The earth of Paguate is scarred by an abandoned uranium mine. To the south of Taos, the Mescalero Apache have contemplated accepting storage of nuclear waste. But Taos has managed to persevere and keep their land from nuclear development. However, the people have not remained untouched. After all, tribal member Tony Lujan, who happens to be my father's godfather, married salon hostess, New York socialite Mabel Dodge, and became the model for the character as Savio in Willa Cather's Death Comes for the Archbishop. For most Pueblos, the harvest feast and other seasonal celebrations are fused with Catholic saints' days. Iconic symbols of tribal leadership include silver-knobbed canes given to the Pueblos by the colonial Spanish governor Juan Oñate, Abraham Lincoln, and in 1980, New Mexico Governor Bruce King. No culture can remain artificially preserved in a pristine past. Accommodations ensure survival as a community keeps what is most sacred to them. For the Taos people, the emblem of sacred endurance is the Blue Lake. Like the Pueblo itself, the lake and its surrounding lands have a history that reflects the land policies toward many Native peoples in the United States. When the Treaty of Guadalupe Hidalgo procured Mexican territories for the United States government in 1848, the agrarian Pueblos were not accorded legal sovereign rights as Indian nations or land title because, in the language of the treaty, they were not wild, wandering savages. Indeed, Wilford Woodruff later declared that the Pueblo peoples must have been Nephites because of their advanced civilization. Nevertheless, through a series of court cases, the Pueblos won the right to be considered independent Indian nations with titled land. Taos' victory was short-lived, however, as Teddy Roosevelt in 1906 seized the Blue Lake and 30,000 surrounding acres for the Carson National Forest, coincidentally named after Kit Carson, who, as Hardy has already related to you, forcibly removed the Navajo from the tribal lands. The Blue Lake area was open to public recreation. Taos people could use it for religious purposes only 3 days of the year, provided they advised the Forest Service in advance. This land loss was more than a simple transfer of title. It was the loss of ontological wholeness. Land seizures and exploitation from the United States government and individual are not only illegal and immoral, but violate the very inalienable rights on which this country was founded. Elizabeth Cook Lynn, Crow Creek Lakota author, explains how the loss of land assaults the essential rights of Native peoples. She says, the very origins of a people are specifically and tribally rooted in geographic place, mythology, and land that are inseparable, and language is rooted in a specific place in the discourse of American Indian nationalism, end of quote. Nevertheless, the freedom to practice religious beliefs and other aspects of the Constitutional Bill of Rights are abrogated on Indian reservations. Reservation lands, despite being sovereign nations, were viewed in terms of their usefulness. The usefulness only is defined by those in power. This particular land, the Blue Lake, and its interconnectedness with how the world is organized and how life is sustained, rituals performed and language learned, transcends economic commodification and legal definitions by a colonial power. With the tenacity that has kept culture alive for 500 years of European contact, Taos fought fiercely to regain their land. Any expendable financial settlements were rejected. Finally, in December of 1970, Richard Nixon signed a bill that returned the land to the tribe. To maintain the sacredness of place, public access is now denied. Taos is resolute in maintaining tribal sovereignty. The Pueblo closes to the public during the winter season, losing substantial revenue earned from tourist visits. Tribal membership currently is restricted by requirements of residency and knowledge of the Tewa language. Cameras, tape recorders, video cameras are forbidden at public ceremonies, and the tribe charges fees for daily camera access at the Pueblo. Certain areas of the Pueblo are always closed to the public. Regardless of these complicated effects and the policies that inspire them, the tribe has the legal right to determine its own degree of involvement with mainstream society in whatever manner it deems will best preserve the integrity of the tribal community. The good of the tribal whole exceeds the need of the individual. Individuals are defined in terms of tribal community. One of my children was assigned a family history project for school. He was given a four-generation chart. Besides personal information, he was to observe mobility in American society, occupational patterns, and European connections. We recognize that most of his predecessors are educators. Although my father was working away from Taos in Toyoak, Colorado, when I was born, everyone else we know in that genealogical line was born, lived, and died in Taos. No migratory pattern there. Though through my husband's family, my children also have five generations associated with Barclay, Nevada. When my son asked about my grandparents' occupations, I told him to record that they were Indians. Their life had no compartmentalization for vocation, leisure, religion, and so forth. They did whatever the tribe expected them to do. Their tasks included ritual preparation of the youth, farming, hunting, baking bread in the earthen ornos, singing, dancing, and ceremonial participation, all determined by the natural cycles of the earth and whatever the tribe determined was necessary. My own life is much more complex. Often I'm tempted to classify my life by the various identities I assume: race, gender, mother, wife, Christian, Mormon, middle-aged, urban, academic, professional, the list goes on. No matter the immediate role, though, these aspects are inseparable and comprise the whole of who I am. Nevertheless, race is omnipresent. One of the most complicated aspects of my life is that racial connection in Mormonism. Because I was raised with the label Lamanite, which lumps all indigenous and Polynesian peoples together regardless of tribal differentiations, I combated and continue to confront basic theological, racial, and cultural misunderstandings. I'm no longer amazed to learn that most Mormons I know believe that Lamanite designates a racial category and the dark side of a good-evil dichotomy, rather than after generations of Nephite and Lamanite intermingling in the Book of Mormon, maybe simply a political classification. I'm aware of uncomfortable issues between the LDS Church and Native peoples, just as I acknowledge the difficult racial history of this Western Hemisphere. Despite my own inner conflicts, common areas of belief contribute to the wholeness of my existence. The Lamanite shall blossom like a rose was the church slogan that saturated my youth. I was never quite sure exactly what that meant, but I believed it to be a good promise and commitment. When read in the context of the scriptures and verses that follow, an amazing sense of place emerges. Now I'll read from the Doctrine and Covenants. But before the great day of the Lord shall come, Jacob shall flourish in the wilderness, and the Lamanite shall blossom as the rose. Zion shall flourish upon the hills and rejoice upon the mountains, and shall be assembled together unto the place which I have appointed. My Mormon historical sense tells me that these verses are about Salt Lake City and the Mormon settling of the American West. My literary native sense reads these lines to indicate some familiar concepts. Zion is both a state of being, pure in heart, and a geographical designation. Identity is inextricable with place. Flourishing and rejoicing are coupled with hills and mountains, nature. Establishing the house of Jacob in the wilderness is linked to whomever may be classified as Lamanites. Indeed, the house of Jacob will be accountable for its relationship to Lamanites. It is impossible to consider Native American issues and Mormonism without going directly to the Book of Mormon. And I don't have a clue whether or not my people are literal descendants of Book of Mormon peoples, nor do I think it matters. For me, the Book of Mormon offers precepts for living rather than historical accounts. Some basic tenets are recognizable, however. Nephi promises survival contingent upon place for his descendants. Joseph's seed should never perish as long as the earth should stand. These descendants may be literal or metaphorically may include all indigenous peoples. As heirs of Columbus, not all native peoples encountered the explorer, but all were impacted by his actions. Likewise, not all native people may be Book of Mormon connected, but they may be affected by the cultural context of the book and its promises of survival. At the beginning of the 20th century, the native population of the United States was less than 200,000, diminished from an estimated population ranging from 10 million to 100 million at the time of European contact. This decrease, as Ojibwa writer Louise Erdrich observes, would be comparative to the United States population diminishing its current size to the city of Cleveland. Considering the history of disease, violence, and assimilation, it is miraculous that any natives have physically survived and that the population is flourishing. Even more amazing is that we have retained our languages, our cultures, and our identities. Perhaps we have not perished in part because we have clung to our identities through the places we are, and despite systematic efforts to remove us from those places. A second familiar ring from the Book of Mormon is the idea of a promised land. While this premise has troubling accoutrements of ideological and political supremacy of essentialism, it nonetheless demonstrates the significance of place. In cultures where livelihood depends on the earth rather than labor in the marketplace, the promise of place is crucial. The idea of a covenant place cements state of being with location. Indeed, the only one of the Ten Commandments that predicates a blessing on a behavior is the Fifth Commandment. Honor thy father and mother, that thy days may be long upon the land which the Lord thy God giveth thee. The promise is not necessarily a long life, but a continuance upon the life-sustaining land. That land is neither an acquisition nor a commodity, but a gift from God. A stewardship of that gift includes a responsibility to the earth. To honor our earthly mothers and fathers, our heavenly mother and father, our mother earth and our father sky, is to acknowledge our heritage, the community of our genetic linkage, and the sacredness of place. As a sacred place, the temple invokes for me a familiarity of ritual worship, rites of passage, and an erasure of the divisions of our worldly existence. The elements of temple ceremony have the spirit of tribal cultures, yet do not replicate precise practices. Washings and anointings acknowledge the integral wholeness of body and spirit. The endowment reminds us that the natural earth is a gift. Sacred ritual clothing is required to worship. The promises made within the temple integrate our spiritual commitments into all aspects of our lives. We enter celestial rooms dressed alike, hierarchies erased, rejoined in a communal whole. The community of Mormonism is one of the most appealing aspects of my faith. I have hope in the ideal, as represented in the scriptures, that all are alike unto God, that no one is esteemed above another, that we may charitably care for one another without qualification or seeking our own. The diversity of our spiritual gifts and individual callings contribute to our communal wholeness, just like the ritual responsibilities of my grandparents contribute to their tribal wholeness. This idealistic hope consoles doubts and soothes pains of history and racism. Being a Native American Mormon is not without trials and absurdities. Because our chapel's street address is on the Arrowhead Trail, I live in the Arrowhead Ward. And when I was the Arrowhead Relief Society president, I was identified with place, calling, and some type of ironic Native identity. I try to reconcile many apparent conflicts of the separate spheres of my life, being an indigenous person in an urban, mechanized society, a female in a male-dominated church, a person from the earth living in a society that has little regard for the earth, being Taos and Mormon. In his great vision, Black Elk, an Oglala holy man describes a sacred hoop which demonstrated the paradox of diversity and unity. He said, And I saw that the sacred hoop of my people was one of many hoops that made one circle, wide as daylight and as starlight. And in the center it grew one mighty flowering tree to shelter all the children of one mother and one father. And I saw that it was holy. I do not consider my Taoist heritage to be mutually exclusive with my Mormon beliefs, but I regard them both as a part of a greater whole of all circumscribed truths. I am a Mormon, and I will always be Taos Pueblo.
Well, we could do. The time's gone, the official time, isn't it? Oh my, well, you're all in trouble then. Maybe I'll read my talk. If we can both see the screen end. No, it's okay. I'll just go ahead. I'd like to say, first of all, that I, as you could probably tell, I found the preceding speakers to be extremely moving. I spend my time engaged in our values. My colleagues who are all non-Mormon all over the world experience the same thing that I do when I ask people to tell me what it is they get up in the morning for, what are the deepest things that they care about. Because the kind of goal process that we use requires that they make a statement about the quality of life that they want to experience. And universally, wherever people are, whatever color they are, whatever culture they come from, my colleagues tell me from all over the world, they give a description which resembles very much Zion. I listened to the previous presentation in this room about paradox, and that was a magnificent preparation for what I have to say, and I hope that all of you will, as you look at those pictures, see the paradox in that destructive forces, supposedly destructive forces, can actually bring about the redemption of land and ecosystems. The principles I've learned as a resource manager, environmental activist, gardener, environmental educator, and outdoorsman fit so comfortably into the principles of my Latter-day Saint heritage and experience with Scripture that I have come to believe that neither the environment nor the doctrines of the Church can be fully understood without a deep knowledge of the other. When President Kimball wanted us all to grow a garden, he had in mind that we experience what John Muir expressed so well, that you cannot pick up one piece of nature, or reality, I would add, without learning that the rest of reality, and therefore nature, is attached to it. He wanted us to learn about life and death, about birth, growth, reproduction, death, and decay. He wanted us to have our hands in them, to see and touch and smell and taste and feel them, to learn why things grow and why they die. I'm sure he wanted us to learn about soil and tilth and about community. I'm sure he knew that many of us would not grow a garden and that many others would learn only the obvious lessons about hard work and reward, and that in that vein of thought would realize they were putting hundreds to thousands of dollars worth of work and expense into producing a few dollars worth of vegetables and that it interfered with their life, and I put that in quotations, and quit doing it. But I'm just as sure that he knew that some few of those whose thinking had followed that line would perceive a sudden stroke of an idea and see from their own logic just how far from the realities of life they are, abstracted from life and supported on a technological bubble of seeming safety and real sameness, which leaves them doomed to struggle against one another in a continual ritualized warfare for market share and dying to sleep or recreate their brains out. Some he knew would even come to understand that their view of nature was corrupted by this recreational context, and that many things are not as they thought they were. President Kimball knew from experience that we would share our vegetables, at least our zucchinis, and that by that process some of us would finally taste a really good carrot or a tomato, and that in learning how they came to be that way would bind us forever to the secrets of the universe. They would come to see things that cannot be learned otherwise, and they would come to know that righteousness is not defined by what we do not do, but rather that every time the scriptures speak that word, they refer to a relationship built on living principles, the rules upon which every organism is constructed, founded on awareness and honesty and sensitivity and appropriate response, and preserved by steadfast obedience and humility. Righteousness is behavior which leads to that relationship, to Zion, where every one of us and every creature and every particle of matter can fulfill the measure of its creation and have joy therein. He knew also that they would come to see and know that all life ultimately depends on that relationship, on Zion, and that our choices are just as Christ described them, between life or righteousness or Zion on the one hand and destruction on the other. If this seems like a tenuous and circuitous way for a prophet to teach a mighty lesson which everyone must learn, I must say that it is no more so than telling people of a school where valuable lessons are taught and suggesting that if people go to that school and pay attention, they will learn the things they teach there. There are many places where we can pick up the thread of reality. Every activity generates real and metaphorical connections to the state of our existence. We can liken the scriptures to ourselves in any endeavor, but if the thread is not followed back to life as a whole, animals, microbes, plants, dung, urine, insects, worms and fungi, water, nutrients and energy, and ourselves, we'll miss the main point. When we look into the sky at night, the universe is trying to give us a complex of messages. Central to and connected to every one of these is that life is very rare and miraculous. These little points of light are so far apart that we cannot humanly have any concept of the distance. It dwarfs our human scale beyond recognition. We are on a tiny concretion of matter surrounded by conditions in which we cannot live, by death, for distance is greater than we can comprehend. Even in the presence of the constituent parts, water, organics, etc., life is a practical impossibility. The arguments for life's happenstance creation have gaps as huge as those between the stars. This realization should leave us humble, grateful, and determined to find and obey the laws by which life is maintained, the peaceable things of the kingdom, the Zion stuff. The knowledge that prophets throughout history have known all this is a uniquely LDS understanding. Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob were cowboys, sheepmen, and transhuman migrant farmers. They were also princes of the royal lineage and ultimate sophisticates. They were members of a friendship and kinship that voyaged among the stars and throughout and through time. They and their spiritual colleagues have seen the end and the beginning. They comprehend humanity profoundly and from a vast perspective, and their knowledge of life and Zion is no less profound. This realization gives great weight to their statements and creates the expectation that their words would fit all measures of truth to the extent that they understood what they saw and were allowed and willing to speak about them, and I might add, if their words were transmitted correctly. And they do fit. Whenever I learn something, I find that some prophet got there before me, long before, and has been trying all my life to teach it to me. The scriptures are properly anthropocentric because we are the problem. It is axiomatic among my colleagues that we have no resource management problems, only people problems. When we make the changes that bring the water and nutrients and energy together on a site, the living organisms all know what to do. They start to work on being what they are, and the result is movement towards Zion, The humans all run around trying to advance their wacky, fragmented, abstract, separate agendas. For they seek not the Lord to establish his righteousness, but every man walketh in his own way, after the image of his own God, whose image is in the likeness of the world, and whose substance is that of an idol, which waxeth old, and shall perish in Babylon, even Babylon the great, which shall fall. There it is again, the fundamental choice between life and destruction. The straight and narrow way versus any old way you please. Brigham understood all this. He taught that if we could just get one group of people to quit fighting, their fighting and strivings and backbiting and cruelty, and serve and not serve the devil anymore, but be obedient to the promptings of the Spirit and stand united, welcoming all who would join them on those principles, seeking one another's welfare and trying to do good to all, the millennium would be here and the healing would spread out from that spot. I want to tell you that from my experience, if the damned humans ever start moving in the general direction Brigham described, the rest of creation responds magnificently. The Mormon concept of death and separation, physical and spiritual, fit perfectly into the reality of the land. Desertification, the loss of biological diversity and life, is a process of separation. The Latin compound desertum, from which the English word desert is derived, could be translated as separation, de, of or from, and serere, series or connectedness. The Great Basin Experiment Station, funded by the USDA, reports that the rangelands of Utah and Nevada could be up to 10 times as productive of biomass as they presently are. The problem is not a dry climate, as most of us suppose, but that the surface of the soil is covered with drainage patterns, and the plant community is fragmented into islands of life and soil anchored by a protecting shrub. As my students come to see what this fragmentation means, they always come to see the parallels between this fragmentation and that of our society. In very brief time, many of them can describe various drainage patterns in society which carry hope and potentials and revenue, etc., out of families and communities, countries and cultures. Fragmentation is always both a feature and a cause of the loss of these potentials and the ongoing death of the entities being drained. Within an hour or two of in a fragmented rangeland, perceptive students wonder how they failed to see the grim consequences of all the selfishness they had thought of as normal all their lives. When they see unfragmented rangeland in the same soils and climate conditions, they are often astonished by the huge differences in abundance of biomass and diversity, and the seemingly minor differences in management that create one condition or the other. When I tell them that functional range management principles are identical for those of successful parenting or marriage, etc., etc., with a few minor changes, and that the minor points are the ones that get all the attention from science, someone always guesses what I mean. The critical skills in each of these efforts are intimacy skills and an understanding of functional boundaries. One bright student summed it up: do unto others as you would have them do unto you if you were in their circumstances, with an extended definition of others in the case of non-humans. If we pay attention to getting the water and the soil into the soil, biological processes will take care of themselves. If we make no demands of any population of living thing, which prevents the majority of them from completing their life cycle, these are all connecting activities. I have my students make lists of attitudes and behavior, skills and competencies to which other people can connect permanently. I ask them to test that list against the requirements of the environment. They find that if people can't connect to you because they can't trust you to allow or help them to fulfill the measure of their creation, you won't do better in the environment. My colleagues and I talk about low succession personalities, people who seek their own way, whose seeking their own way causes people and land around them to fragment, separate, and die emotionally, spiritually, and in every other way. When people who are my students sometimes ask me people who are my students sometimes ask me if we are in a resource management seminar or a Sunday school. I point out that I have generally made no religious references at all. What they are experiencing is the powerful emotional and spiritual consequences of the connecting up of their fragmented knowledge about people, ethics, and science. Life and death are the fundamental pattern of reality and of the scriptures and the gospel. The Savior and his prophets never discuss any other topic. We are protected from death by gathering into organic communities which are purified of the principles of separation, confusion, chaos, and therefore of death. The imagery of the restoration is that of the pure light, the gospel, correct information, overcoming confusion and its consequences, death and hell. The confusion of our age suffers from is the delirious notion that we can benefit separately from each other. All the things we desire are created and maintained by relationships which exist in reciprocity or equity. Iniquity and inequity are the same word. Wickedness is simply weakness. The English word, I understand, derives from the Saxon wioked, which meant weak. To be wicked is to be overcome or conquered by evil. You're weak, you get conquered, you do weak, stupid things which are destructive of living relationships. 1 John deals with this at length. We have in Alma, through Korihor, the pure version of the virus, and humanity is not the virus, it's this information, the pure version of the virus which overcomes and destroys us, the consequences of which inevitably move into the environment to which we are inextricably linked. You fare according to the management of the creature, you conquer according to your strength, you prosper according to your genius, and whatsoever a man doeth is no crime. There is no God, no Christ, no redemption. There is no meaning. Everything is simply an expression of random forces. These statements are at the heart of separation. Most of all, they cut those infected by them off from the perception of the damage they do. They are sealed in a sub-reality which generates individual, societal, familial, and environmental destruction. The symbolism of the temple in Salt Lake City refers to a fixed point, the North Star, and to orderly cycles. If people are not ready to see Christ and Zion as their reckoning point and goal, let me suggest that they use life as a whole, or biodiversity, for now. If they honestly seek the interests of the whole of life, including people, the threads of truth will soon enough lead them to Zion and its King. Environmental destruction is primarily an ethical problem engendered by the Korihor virus and spinning in a vicious cycle. The lack of ethical creativity and discipline leads to environmental problems and greater scarcity, which further attacks the integrity and so on to collapse. It is called, in several levels in the Doctrine and Covenants, the desolation of abomination. In closing, let me say that I do not believe that the parallels between the functioning of the communities in nature and human communities and the complex interconnections between them are coincidental. I believe they are types following a fundamental pattern. Quick fix addictive behavior in agriculture and ecosystem management follows the same downward spiral of separation and death that drug addicts experience for the same reason. Our food supply, for the most part, depends at present on a chemical addiction which, like other drugs, is losing its effectiveness and rising in cost while damaging the living system to which it is applied, to which the chemicals are applied. Many who perceive this problem offer solutions based on a reciprocal addiction to outdoor recreation, which is a very fine thing in its place, but which solutions, if universally applied, would devastate agriculture and most ecosystems in the West. Either extreme leaves us with growing deserts which most people don't even perceive. Addictions are the fundamental problem. In the recovery community, addictions are described as God-shaped holes in the soul, which we try to fill with other things. Time does not excuse me, my own handwriting here. Time does not permit me to elaborate, but our addiction to single-purpose land management has placed us in an accelerating situation where the famines, plagues, and conflicts foretold for the last days could be triggered by a handful of very possible events. Had we been striving towards Zion and living relationships all this time, things would be very different. I want to reiterate the connection that my non-Mormon colleagues and myself see between living land and people of integrity and vision, imagination, discipline, caring, and courage, and faith. These people are finding their way towards Zion, whether they know about it or not. They have fine, strong families and good values and healthy land. At the same time, I want to emphasize the connection that we see between environmental destruction and people without a solid set of values to which they can connect and on which solid living decisions can be based. I've seen miracles of healing done by the former. Nothing the latter can do will long persist except the destruction their blindness creates. Now, I'd like to point out a couple of things on the photographs. That's another of the ranches that I operate. The former picture, with where you saw all the dying grass, hasn't been grazed for, since Glen Canyon Dam was started some 40 years ago. I'm in the business of helping people see how their livestock and how their various agricultural activities can blend into the development of biodiversity and health. And again, we don't see my colleagues and I, and we work in North Africa and all over the United States and in Pakistan and elsewhere. We don't see that there really are any resource management problems. The land knows what to do. The organisms of the land are not confused as to what to do. As soon as we start trying to cooperate with them and with the living patterns that many of us don't perceive, then things fix themselves. And on a 10 scale, the human problems generally are a 7 to a 10, and the environmental problems are about a 3. Thank you.
I was telling Jane, if there are not any questions, it's like we've been like a boring Sunday school class. And so we hope we've been provocative enough. At least I've learned enough from these other two speakers to want to talk with them for hours about these things. Are there anything
you want to ask Steve or vice versa?
Well, Jane left me in tears and sniffling through my talk.
Yeah.
If you have a comment to make, why don't you come up here so we can get... Okay, I'll repeat it.
Well, we live in the country, and how do you suggest that we help people be aware of these things that we're not, in touch with every day, except for the little squad line that we're on, and where they can get a sense of this and feel the, our lives so connected. And the land is so connected with everything that we do in the gospel. Because I think we are not invested in that. We just have a concept of what the Bible means and what we need to do.
The question is, and I'm going to paraphrase. How can folks who live in urban areas who are not in touch as much as they would like to be with the real world, the environment, get that feel and get that sense of place or begin to teach their children that sense of place
and the
connections that there are between? My quick answer would be hire Steve and Jane to come and talk to your Relief Society group, your class, show these pictures, even better. Take your ward youth, for example, for a day out on the land with people like Steve Rich, or another rancher, or Jane Belknap, Steve, do you have anything you want to add to that?
Well,
there are some fundamental rules environmentally that our whole society is going to have to learn if it's going to persist. One of them is, and it was dealt with very eloquently in the preceding session, is to come to realize that you can be wrong. The decision-making process that we teach gives people a holistic goal. They develop a holistic goal where they get in touch with their deepest values, and then they do a backcasting process. You know, you're familiar with forecasting, but having decided that we want a life like this, then we ask what has to be produced in order to support those values. And that includes opportunities for solitude and clean water and clean air and the kind of environment that produces those things. But what has to be produced in order to support our values? Then we ask, what does the resource need to be like in order to support both the productions and the values in perpetuity? And then we examine our present circumstances on the resource and see how they compare with the resource that we need to have to support our values. And go through a process where we look at every possible human action, the influence, the resource, the land, and by that I'm talking about the water cycle, the nutrient cycle, energy flow, and community dynamics toward the kind of community that we want to live in environmentally. Then we put our plan through a testing procedure where we test to see whether our plan looks like it's going to be sound from an environmental standpoint, also from a financial or economic standpoint, and then from an ethical and cultural standpoint, including cultures that are not our own. And having done all this work, we then operate from the procedure that we very well, or from the premise that we very well may be wrong in our plan, and we have a process of monitoring whereby we get early warning from our neighbors and from the organisms themselves as to whether we're really doing what we intended to do or not. And until we get in touch with those fundamental processes, what's happening to the water, for instance, the people I work with routinely cause streams to flow again that have not flowed for 100 years. We raise water tables. But our culture is not at all in tune with the water cycle. We don't understand it. We live here in a dry climate and behave as though we were in a very wet one. And we don't understand the principles by which water gets into the ground and how it flows as a culture. And so as voters, we oftentimes do stupid things. And again, we've got to understand the nutrient cycle and energy flow and community dynamics profoundly, and you have to get out on the land to do that. Yes? Bud and Hardy. Yeah.
I feel the comments that have been made have been quite thoughtful, but I still feel that it's somewhat one-sided in the discussion today. We've seen a lot of slides that talk about grazing land, and I think it's interesting that if we look at the Word of Wisdom, section 89, that we would only eat meat in times of winter or famine, and yet we seem to take as a given that we need to dedicate a huge amount of our open lands to running livestock. I see something inconsistent in that with Mormon theology right at the very beginning. I also... Somebody eats them. My family recently tried to go on a hike up Bell Canyon near my home and were turned away because there isn't any access to that canyon. In fact, we still go hiking there, but you have to step over a no trespassing sign. If private property rights prevent my children or grandchildren from being able to appreciate our Heavenly Father's, the mountains and the deserts, then there's something wrong there, in my opinion. I also have some reservations. I think that as a society, Mormon society, we're going on the basis that we still need to multiply and replenish the earth. That was a plan that was basically set in place at the time of Genesis. And yet, do we still need to continue multiplying and replenishing the earth at this stage of the earth cycle as at that stage? I, as a scout growing up in the west side of the Salt Lake Valley, my brothers and I would get on our bikes and ride our bikes all over this valley. There was practically no traffic there. I would never turn my kids loose on a bicycle in the Salt Lake Valley today. I just wonder if it isn't time for a new spirit of inspiration or revelation with regards to this issue of continuing to multiply and replenish the earth. I think as a modern society, we're somewhat clueless about the impact that we're having on the world. And I think that we seem to be incapable of changing our behavior. And at least for me, being a Mormon does not mean mindlessly destroying, developing, or so-called improving the earth. I don't think that's necessary. Thank you.
Did you get to comment on the former topic?
Go ahead. I'd like to directly address your question, Charlotte. And because I do live in an urban setting, and I can't take my children to New Mexico every time I want to, and I can take them to Berkeley, Nevada, which gives them a sense. But what's interesting to me about this discussion is that we're talking about the environment as if it's some sort of other, some sort of place out there, instead of looking at where we are and where we live. And I think that that's one way we can become connected to the earth in our urban homes, in our little pieces of ground, no matter how small they can be. And it can be simply in recognizing what you said, what is the natural environment of our location. So, for example, in Henderson, Nevada, where I live, we experiment with desert landscaping in our front yard, in our backyard, and we take the time to observe what's going on with the little critters, you know, even little bugs, and being aware, taking the time to observe and use your sensory perceptions, you know, in some ways it doesn't matter if you're out there in the environment or if you're in your home environment too. I think that that's crucial, and it's something I struggle with on a larger basis because of these tribal connections, because my children are growing up as urban Indians, and so it encloses a whole range of trying to help them understand who they are in their environment now, in the here and now.
Well, I appreciate those comments, and I appreciate your comments. In answer to Charlotte's question, I've got one other pitch I would make, is that I help teach an environmental ethics course in San Juan County. It's really sponsored by the Four Corners School. It's about a week-long deal where we go out on the land and do a lot of the things. They pay me exactly what I'm worth, which is nothing, but we have a lot of fun for a week really looking at things on the ground. That's another possibility. I guess I want to respond to one. I think a lot of things you say are right. The one response I would have about you're not being able to go into a certain canyon, it's kind of like me not being able to use your car or your house if I want to. And one of the values that I hold very strongly, it maybe comes from thou shalt not steal, but I have a feeling that I don't have the right to use all the resources in the earth for my own self just because I want to use them. There are areas in the world that I can't go because other people own them. I mean, I wouldn't dream of going down to the Blue Lake area and going onto that land without asking the owners if it was okay or of paying. The reason is that as a landowner, I feel like somebody is stealing from me if they go on my land to hunt or if they use my property without asking permission. The same way I hope that you would feel if I moved into your house or... So this area of property rights, nobody likes to hear that word, property rights. But respect for other people's property is one measure of the civility
of Christianity or the Judeo-Christian heritage. And I just respectfully suggest that you be aware of that, that it looks like nobody's there, nobody's using it. But if you were the landowner, you would kind of like to know who was there and maybe warn them about fire danger or so on. Gene?
Hardy, I really appreciated your beginning this by asking us to think back to basic principles. And I think we often need to do that. I guess the question I'd like you to consider and all of us to consider is when we do that, if we really can, and I think people like Steve and Jane can help us because of their expertise, get over our prejudices and our assumptions about the meaning of words. Let me just raise two questions, and I don't have answers, but I'd like you especially to think about them, Hardy. Because one of your basic principles, which you've reiterated to us now, is property rights. And I share your feeling about that. But as I think about Jane's people, and I think about what Steve's trying to do for the future, I wonder if we can use that word as glibly as we do. For instance, how did it get to be that we own the property in Utah? It belonged, what, to Jane's people, her, or other people who, in some cases, we have wiped out. So in what sense do we have a property right to our little piece of property? It certainly isn't a legal one, it's a strange cultural one. That is, this kind of property right that we in America at this time have defined is not a God-given one. It's a very limited one in time and space. And so it seems to me we've got to be careful about making basic principles on that. For instance, we have a little piece of property in South Fork Canyon, up Provo Canyon, 50 by 100. Now, that property somehow got into the hands of Anglos, but it wasn't always so. It was in the hands of someone that it was wrested from originally, who had religious interests in it, for whom it might have meant the same thing that Blue Lake meant. Now, you would respect that now because it's been defined by our laws, but we didn't respect it originally. And, in fact, the people for whom that might have been a sacred territory, we have in one way or another wiped out. Now, what does that mean? Is that to be forgotten? I don't think so. The other thing that's interesting about that area is it's the watershed for Provo. Now, if we own that little piece of property, do we own the trees that were there before we owned it? Do we own the water under it? Do we own the air above it, the side of it from the road? Next to us is a person who has 120 acres. Pursuing this notion of property rights to its limit, supposedly he could do anything he wanted on that property, but if he does, he will destroy the view of hundreds of people from Provo who could come up and look at that valley, a valley which also includes some land owned by the government. Now, does that mean those people own that too, and in what sense do they own it? Do you see what I'm saying? I think property rights is a very complex issue which we haven't thought about very much, and part of it is the future. In what sense do my children, the children of all the people of Provo, all the people of this country, all the people of the world, own my property? Because what I do with my property will affect their lives, their air, their water, what they see in the future forever. So I would agree with you. I think we've got to get back to first principles, and I appreciate you especially helping us see that there's got to be some place between the extremes of I can do anything I want on my property and men are, and women are a virus that have got to be done away with. Those are clearly extreme positions that seem to me out of line with the gospel. And our struggle as human beings between those is to try to get back to first principles and listen to the testimony of people who are more expert than us and have deeper feelings because of that, and see if we can find some place in between to cooperate as a community to achieve long-term values.
I'm grateful for that, and I realize, Gene, that property rights are plural and are a bundle of rights, and they sometimes come in conflict. The right of somebody to divide a piece of land, 120 acres, into a plot of land 100 by 200 is one of those rights that society in some cases has said you can't cut it up into lots that small because of the problems. that you indicated, and property rights, like anything else, are not absolute. I guess what I ask for is respect on both sides. Those who want to look at the property and have it be beautiful so they can look at it and maybe hike on it, and have some respect for the ownership. How we define that?
This particular situation I was describing, apparently you have to cross a small area of privately owned land,
okay,
which is a national forest land.
Okay.
There's no natural legal access to the natural forest.
Let me give you one. This brings to mind one experience. We've got a pasture down on the way to Monticello between two highways that I call a trespass pasture. I'm trying to change the name of it for PR reasons now. But the reason we call it the trespass pasture is that I own some of the land in that fenced-in area. And I was reseeding it, plowing the brush up and reseeding it, which I think is a good thing, or thought was a good thing. I knew roughly where the line was that was government land, was BLM, managed by the BLM land. But I said to the guy, just keep plowing and throwing seed on the ground. And so here he was, moving up onto the BLM land and reseeding. And the BLM guy called me, and he was a good friend of mine, good LDS fellow, and he said, one of the worst things I've ever heard in my life. He said, I never expected that of you, Hardy. I never expected, because it was dishonest. And I've never felt worse in my life. And what I learned from that experience is that I ought to respect. I mean, this land's owned by all the people. I was improving it. I mean, you can go through all the rationalizations. But what I realized then, as I've never realized before, that no matter where it came from, no matter whether the Spanish stole it from the Indians and we took it in the war, that my obligation to another individual or to another group of individuals was to respect not only themselves, but respect what they owned and not take advantage of it. And so I've repented of that. But that's an example of how we can rationalize. Now, I guess what I want to say is I can solve other... My dad used to say, I can run other people's ranch a lot better than I can run my own. What if you went to the guy who owned that, or the person who owned that, and said, this is what we'd like to do, and this is why we'd like to do it. Is there a possibility we can work something out? Is there a possibility we can use it so many days of the year so we don't establish a right-of-way by not eminent domain? You can establish property rights by using it for so long, and so we don't run the risk of doing that. I guess what I'm saying is using a conciliatory and an upfront approach that I didn't use with the BLM to see if something can be worked out. And maybe it can be done, and maybe it can't. But I guess those are the ways I like to solve problems rather than either taking or either by force. Any other questions that...
Did anyone else on the panel want to comment on that?
So come up here and state your piece.
Many of the pictures that you showed look like around the LaSalle Mountains.
There were Steve's pictures, so I'm going to let him answer that.
Well, and a lot of the pictures were from around the Kaibab Plateau in northern Arizona, looking up into southern Utah and back towards.
Some from around the LaSalle.
There were some west of there, over in Colorado, or east of there in Colorado. Yeah.
We've kept this at a very nice and pleasant level. I wonder if you'd talk about something controversial and how these principles apply. The chief mission for facing Utah is large areas of land that some people propose to be put in government control, and others would like to keep for natural development. How do you deal with that?